Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
Who is in the same studio as Brian Brushwood.
Yeah, it's really weird. It's like the Skype lag is just extraordinary.
I know.
The fidelity. It's like you're right here.
Oh, geez.
And also in that same studio, not me. No, I'm not. I'm a thousand miles away. But I mean, in the studio with everybody else hanging out, just because it's the dudes, Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Well, I'm working. I'm working the show.
Yeah. All right. I get it. Fine. As soon as this is done, and then maybe another podcast to make you feel better, Andrew, I'm going to get on a plane. I'm going to fly right back to California so we can then reorient the balance of power to be 50-50.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you're there because, I drove by Saturday night. Took a little peek at, and you guys didn't because you were together doing your little hangout together.
Did you go to the Big Top, the tent, and peek at them setting up the sideshow?
I drove by.
Dude, that's awesome. So for the uninitiated, everybody, I guess today's the day. Later today, they're going to make the announcement, whatever it is.
Yeah. Side note, I spent about $5,000 on a really cool 3D printer, right? Like this thing's the size of Danny DeVito. It's amazing. And I had named myself after Elon Musk announced the new BFR Big Falcon spaceship, which is the big thing they're building. I built this. I built the full thing, the full stack.
Holy cow.
Days and days and days printing this garbage. Done. Just trash.
Wait, why? What do you mean? I thought you were like the biggest fan of the BFR.
They changed it.
Oh.
So Andrew spent all that money and all that time printing everything out, and he was so excited to go get a look at whatever they're setting up, and next thing you know, he spent $5,000 and all that time and effort to build a broken dream.
Yeah.
Don't dream anymore, guys.
A very limited edition. Oh, by the way, did you see the random guy on the street talking to Neil deGrasse Tyson who got him to—
Did I send that to you?
Okay. Hey man, I don't remember where stuff comes from. I just remember I saw it.
Yeah, Neil deGrasse Tyson's like, "Hey, give Elon a break. Elon's the best game we got going right now." You know, the staunch Elon Musk defender, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
I'm glad that I agree with Neil deGrasse Tyson on the exploration of space.
There are two things I agree with him on: stars and what they're made of and how the universe works, and his opinion at this moment of Elon Musk.
Yes, specifically at this moment.
So what we were talking about is that over the weekend, or I think Friday, Elon Musk, And I'm reminded of I was talking to Justin a week ago about like the ups and downs of Elon Musk, and Justin made some comment like, "Well, Elon's going to do something and he'll be the hero again and he'll be on top again." Yeah. And I'm like, sage advice, because Elon's like, "Oh yeah, Monday we're going to announce who the first passenger is going to be to take a trip around the moon on our brand new shiny rocket."
And that's the big thing, is that ultimately, Elon Musk is a fascinating figure for a lot of different reasons, and he is going to suffer disproportionately because he is a celebrity as well as a CEO for things in his private life and for things that we like to criticize and laud celebrities for in general. But the thing that he has on his side is that when he succeeds, he is succeeding at things that we don't normally see, right? It's not just like even companies that we like, software companies or hardware companies that do things that change our lives, they're coming out with a new phone, they're coming out with a new program, they're coming out with new apps, and it's like, cool, but I guess that's just your business model. His business model is sending people around the moon for the first time ever that a private company has just offered this to somebody. This is going to be the first customer to do it. This is groundbreaking stuff. And that's what an advantage that he has in this bizarre cycle of us freaking out about literally everything that he does.
Speaking of Musk, I guess he made some announcement about bricks, super cheap, subsidized from the Boring Company.
Yeah. So the side note, the Boring Company, which is just one of his other ventures, which is developing tunneling technology. The hope is to sort of apply the same sort of engineering know-how they did with SpaceX and Tesla to tunneling, because if you can tunnel underneath things, you open up it. You can all build roads really in kind of a 2D flat surface, but you can tunnel beneath the tunnels and keep building tunnels as much as you want. So what they're doing now is you have all this dirt, pull out of a tunnel, got a lot of dirt. And they figured out a way to take this dirt and compact them into bricks, which they say are, you know, like the best bricks. They're really, really good bricks. And what they're going to be doing is selling these bricks for like 50 cents a piece or giving them away for like affordable housing projects.
Oh, wow.
So, I'm going to do a quick comment. In the comment section, Lucky Gecko points out when Elon Musk put the car into space that it wasn't good, you know, stewardship. And, you know, that's a point that's brought up, like, hey, they put a car into space. Was that really, you know, was that a, you know, stunt? Supposedly the SpaceX went to NASA and whatnot and said, hey, are there any experiments, anything you want to do on there? They're like, we don't have really time frame. And normally when they do these test experiments, when they do this stuff just to test a payload on a rocket, they just put weight. They just put like concrete blocks or whatever to see what's going to happen. They don't put anything in there. So I would argue and say, like, yeah, like every other Atlas or Delta launcher, they've done that. That was a waste too. At least here you see 6-year-old kids or 7-year-old kids in kindergartens who've drawn pictures of this and talk about it. I would say, my opinion, it was a great – if you're going to use a test cargo, it was a great test cargo.
Yeah, and let's say it cost him out of pocket or out of the company's pocket, let's say $1 million. Like $1 million has been spent on less valuable art, objectively, than this right here.
Yeah, and the point wasn't, hey, watch me put a car in space. Was like, hey, we've got to show this rocket's rated to carry heavy payloads for NASA, for the Air Force, whatever. But before we risk something and blow it up, you know, let's do that. And that's also, there was a high factor because, you go to NASA and, like, do you want to put anything on board? And you know, people like, and some diehard SpaceX fans are like, well, NASA said no. I'm like, well, it's not like, hey, John, take this experiment you've been working on for 20 months and put it on this thing that
on this
they blow
highly
up,
speculative, you know, like, test run of this technology. Yeah.
Yeah, there are reasons to be, you know, it's more complicated, but, you know, by all means, nobody's above, you know, questioning. Nobody's above,
sure.
No, we're big fans of Elon Musk. Like, people bring up issues in his factory. So they're like, we need to ask these questions, but also listen to the answers.
Well, yeah, and this is the fact that I just love repeating whenever anything SpaceX or the silliness of SpaceX is highlighted is that this is a company that was started from the problem, how can I live stream a greenhouse from Mars?
Yeah.
And the solution to that eventually became, I need to build my own rockets to do it. If that is where the company starts, live streaming a car in space with a spaceman and a drop top in it is, you know, him capturing the public's attention and giving a, you know, it is a little song, a little dance, a little seltzer down your pants, but that's all we've wanted when we talk about whether or not people should care about space and space education and what the future could be, is that little, you know, a little glittering lore that makes things not just a science project, that makes it exciting.
So back to the BFR, they changed it, but they have not revealed the new design. Is that what I'm taking from
real quick. Lil Inc, by the way, says that the bricks are going to be 10 cents a piece, which is – so that was like a little correction from the comment section. Yeah. So, yeah, they've changed the design of it considerably. And actually, Elon tweeted out photos. If you go to either his Twitter or like on Reddit, you can see the new design of it. The version that I have here, it had like these – the two kind of the – these are more stabilizers at the back, kind of winglets is what they were. Not designed for really so much aerodynamic lift as much as when it's entering the atmosphere is to keep it stable. Now what they've added is a third one that comes up here, and they actually at one point they're at kind of point all three pointing out like kind of like a classic rocket design, and they put the landing legs on the end of the wings or the whatever they are, so it will have some stability. And there's another image they show of it flying by the moon. And they've added like front little small like mini wings or canards as they're called for stabilization. So we'll probably hear more about that. We'll hear more today. They're doing the press conference 6 p.m. Pacific time. They're going to announce who the passenger is going to be. Who is paying the ticket?
Reading the tea leaves here, do you think the mere fact that they feel like this is an announceable thing
makes it a public figure. Like, I had never heard of Dennis Tito until he was on the news as the guy going up. Like, if it's another Dennis Tito, another no-name whoever, I don't know. Maybe who knows? Maybe that's part of how they got that big paycheck for this space tourist. Is they're like, look, we'll even make you famous. We'll have a big unveiling. Everyone on the planet is going to know your name.
I would suspect it's more likely somebody who's not a household name. I think it's more likely another PayPal founder than it is Justin Bieber.
Right.
Like that. It's just somebody that is a gigantic enthusiast. Probably somebody that has supported Musk.
Have they revealed the price tag on this?
No, we'll probably find out. I'd heard rumors as far as the number I'd heard prior for doing like the Falcon Heavy moonshot was like 60 million, 70 million, something like that. This may be higher. But so the rumors are somebody had asked Elon, is it you? Elon replied with a tweet of an emoji for the Japanese flag. So the speculation's been it might be, you know, there's a Japanese startup guy. It could be there's like the son of the guy who started SoftBank. So the speculation it might be a very wealthy Japanese businessman who is paying for this ride. And the funny thing is like, you know, what, you know, if you want to turn, if you have a lot of money and you know you're going to have money forever and you want to turn some of that money into some sort of asset that never goes away, buying yourself to be the first person in like 50 years to go beyond Earth orbit.
Yeah.
Think about this. Nobody's gone in beyond Earth orbit in almost 50 years.
Wow. I think when was the last moon mission was what? 72, 73?
373, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. That means in my lifetime, not one living human being has ever beheld the planet Earth with their eyes all in one stop, all in one look. And he will be the first person to see it as a beautiful blue orb.
That's insane. Yeah.
In my lifetime.
I mean, that's just that. So you're and particularly if it's from Japan, like you're instant, you know, national hero and whatnot. And that's kind of awesome. And it's going to be exciting because whoever this is, you know, we're going to want to follow the journey of this person who's going to the furthest. And so what they're doing is called a free return trajectory, which basically means you fly away from Earth and you'd go do a loop over the moon, around the moon, but you're not going fast enough that you're going to actually enter into like lunar orbit. You're basically going up and coming back down to Earth because you're still basically pulled back in by Earth's gravity. And so that's the way this works. So it doesn't take as much fuel as like trying to orbit the moon. And so depending upon the shape of this, this could be the furthest a human's ever traveled from Earth.
Oh, wow. I mean, just no matter what, the more we get into this conversation, the more you realize how significant it is. That because like SpaceX is in this weird space now where we're kind of we have the funny thing is we've been joking for years about how ho-hum the progress of SpaceX has kind of become to people who see it all the time. Where now sure. It's like, oh yeah, like oh it's cool. They're gonna launch a rocket. Oh, they launched a rocket. That's cool. They launch rockets all the time. Oh, they're gonna land a rocket. Oh, they landed a rocket. They land rockets all the time. Oh, they're gonna do a full mission with the rockets landing. Oh, now it's a thing. And now we get another one of those like, oh wait, now we're fully back from the moment that SpaceX is founded to right now. We are watching SpaceX replicate the process of putting a man on the moon oh so many years ago. Now they're obviously not going to land on it, but to be able to be breaking those kind of barriers that you would be the person to go out the furthest into space ever for probably like 5 minutes. It'll be a short-lived record because we're spending more and more time up there. But this is amazing. This is so cool.
Yeah, I mean it's also a big deal because the hardware, the big Falcon rocket that they're using to do this with, the spaceship and the booster, and what Brian and I were talking about before is they're actually building this. I mean, they're building this rocket, right? It's not a paper rocket in the sense that, yeah, we're going to build this thing one day. There's hardware in place in California, in Los Angeles, in the Port of Los Angeles. They can't build the full outer size, outer shape of this at the SpaceX factory, which is huge, by the way. I went by there and you can, they have a whole Hyperloop tunnel that goes like over a mile long or whatever. It's insane. And you see how many more buildings are now SpaceX over there. It's insane, but they'll be building a large part of it there, but a big assembly is going to be the port. And they already have a massive tent, which is, you know, they've built, Boeing's built airplanes inside of tents. It's okay. Don't worry. Don't panic when you hear a tent, where they're doing the assembly there. So they're building this thing now. They're building this thing now. And so, you know, Joe Biden just saying like, let's.
I do love the fact that, depending on how you want to define it, I mean, the BFR will be the first real spaceship in the Millennium Falcon kind of sense of the word that I've ever seen, you know, because you had certainly the space shuttle was reused, but everything else got disposed of, you know, giant rocket. You had to build entire rockets with the purpose of throwing them away and so on. Just the idea of like, no, this is the spaceship and it could just keep on flying and on and on and on.
And it's a spaceship that, you know, we'll probably hear some more talk about it. Like, SpaceX is really serious about using this as Earth-to-Earth travel, the idea that for certain long distances.
How many people do you think have called dibs on a ride like this? Like, obviously, we'll hopefully find a little bit more about, like, how the person that got this ride and how early and how much and however many details we can get there, but... Is this just like a very awesome notes app thing on Elon's phone to be like, who called dibs first and who has already sent me money?
Yeah, certainly, you know, SpaceX wisely so decided they weren't going to try to make their primary business model tourism. And I have friends involved in space tourism, and I think it's a neat idea. But to me, it's not the thing that I'd want to base an industry upon, particularly when the real benefits, in my opinion, come from the technological research, the medical technologies, all these incredible things that happen from, you know, weightless experimentation. All that's where I look at that. And it's like, you know, it's like looking at the microchip and saying, you know, this will be great for HP calculators forever. And it's like, oh, it's more. But SpaceX has said they found they had a much stronger interest and they realized. And right now, remember, Tesla launched off the Roadster, let some really, really rich people, you know, pay a lot of money for this little sports car with a small range but goes really fast. Let a lot of rich people who have got money to spare pay for your development, then come out with the thing for the Model S, then the Model 3 for everybody else, because that's the goal. That's where they want to be. They want to be for, you know, be a product for everybody, and that's what's happening here. They're now going, well, you know, like, yeah, if we let somebody pay $100 million for this launch or $100 million for this, you know, we're starting to cover some of our operational expenses to develop it so that when we are in the position to do, you know, we don't have to borrow as much money or whatever. So that's, I think, Gwynne Shotwell, who's the president of SpaceX, has talked about.
Right on.
And talk about, you know, what a revolution this would be for Earth-to-Earth travel. The idea... That, I mean, they're talking like what, New York to Tokyo in
15 minutes or something,
like 30 or 40, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it.
Brian's like, oh, 40 minutes, I'm out.
Yeah,
I was like, well, at least there'll be time for drink service.
I mean, look, if you even look at the history of air travel, like from the late 50s to the early 1960s, it used to be about the same time to go from New York to LA as it is now. The time it takes to go from New York to London. And so all of a sudden, a cross-country trip, for which I'm going to do later this afternoon, becomes a lot more of a realistic idea. You have to plan less for it. It's less of a gigantic extravagance. If we can fold the world even further with stuff like this, I mean, that just dramatically reshapes what we think about commutes and travel. Well,
it also
what's
opens
possible.
Up... Here's an interesting thing. This is maybe more of an after things topic, but we're not going to get to after things today. Like, my fundamental business model changed when after around the time 9/11 happened, and all of a sudden airline rates went very, very low because nobody wanted to fly.
Yeah.
And because of that, I pivoted the type of show I did. I figured out, like, okay, right now I drive around with a 4x6 trailer and there's a whole bunch of stuff and I'm all concerned about making it feel like a big stage show. What if I did the reverse? What if I figured out a way to get everything small so that it felt big, but I was able to fly with it? This is back when you could do 3 70-pound trunks on Southwest Airlines.
Oh, wow.
And keep in mind, later, you know, if you got a companion pass, that's somebody else who goes for free, which is three more 70-pound trunks. All of a sudden, you could fly with 400 pounds of gear for the cost of a single one-way ticket. Like, once that happened, my entire business changed. All of a sudden, I was able to leave in the morning and fly to Des Moines and do a show that night and then turn around the next day and come on back. And it was cost effective. And as a result, a type of touring show that did not exist up until that moment was possible. And so I don't know what the amazing business models are that are going to come up next, but I know that it's making something possible that was never possible before, which means somebody can build a business based on the fact that this is now a doable thing.
Certainly. And you think about the challenges are going to be when they talk about doing point to point on Earth is one. These things are, these are rocket launches. This is going to be the most powerful rockets ever launched. And so it's like, you know, watching a Saturn V launch. So you need to put them in locations either out at sea, you know, they're going to minimize sound, or you're going to put them in locations where you're going to have that. So it's going to have to, you're going to reshape sort of the part of the way we think about transportation in some sense, you know, and of course, making sure that it doesn't take forever to get to where you're going to launch from. But there are certain locations, places like around the world where this is going to make a lot, will make a lot of sense. And it's not going to get rid of airplane travel, whatever. I mean, at all. You know, it's going to be this other kind of, it'll certain long haul routes and stuff it might be competitive with. But I think SpaceX is going to have more of a problem with a bandwidth issue of how many of these things can they launch. But it does.
I'll tell you what, just think of one thing. Think about just the organ donation market. All of a sudden, donor banks can have global efficiency instead of regional efficiency. Because right now you get somebody, they harvest an organ, you know, a kidney or whatever, somebody runs to a plane and there's only so far you could go. I mean, there's nobody who's dying in Pensacola, Florida, and then their kidney ends up in Osaka, Japan in time to put into someone else. Or maybe that is the case, or maybe it's a near thing. But then all of a sudden, it's like that efficiency for those few every second really matters moments all of a sudden makes possible donor matching.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what the international rules are on that kind of thing. But certainly medical things like the treatment, I mean, like, you know, if they're saying the price of these tickets are going to be like, you know, first class or business class or whatever, and that's a thing that's an interesting thing. It's like the company is right now trying to figure out a way for a business class airfare. You get to go into space.
Yeah.
then go to where you want. Kind of crazy, but it does. Yeah, it's you get, you know, in New England along, you know, the Acela corridor, you get people who say, oh, I can live in this one state and go work over here. And, you know, in Europe with certain, some of the really efficient train systems like that, in Japan, you know, where the privately run train systems and stuff, you can, you know, I worked at a resort in Japan years ago, and it was in the mountains in the Japanese Alps, and it was, you know, like on by bullet train or so, it was like an hour and a half outside of Tokyo. By train, by car, was much, much longer. It was hours and hours and hours. And the way the resort worked was, at the end of the day in Tokyo, businessmen and women, they would hop on this train, hop on the bullet train, take it up to this resort, get out. And the resort was, had gambling, had drinking, whatever. They put on these yukata robes. They'd go get drunk, eat a lot, come watch a magic show or variety show kind of thing, go back, gamble, go to sleep, wake up the next day, go back to work.
Yeah.
And it was this kind of cool resort thing that was made possible because, you know, Japan's a small country, but they could have this transportation system to take you from there and there. And so I'm thinking that's the thing to think about is like, are we going to get a Las Vegas, you know, the Las Vegas SpaceX port, which goes from straight there to, you know, Riyadh or wherever, you know, that's the thing to think about how that all of a sudden, when you know that like some of the best, most wealthy clientele in the world are only 40 minutes away.
Yeah, you know, it seems like a Vegas-y thing to do to make sure that you can, if you get bored of the tables in Macau, that it's only an hour and you can try your luck at the Vegas tables.
That makes sense. You open up because I'm certain, you know, there's certain parts of the Vegas experience that are unique to Vegas. And if all of a sudden you're able to get Saudi princes and it's only, you know, a 45 minute trip.
Well, when you think about that, the idea that let's say you have a Vegas one, you have, you know, Singapore one, you have, you know, wanna Dubai, the Dubai route, the idea that you can make your way around the world in 3 hours.
That's insane. I mean, it's just, it's so crazy. But, you know, now it makes, you know, so what does a private jet look like? Like, are you an idiot if you're the one, if you're the Saudi prince who's still flying on a private jet?
Well, look at the upholstery in my stagecoach.
Yeah, exactly. It, like, it just becomes a dirigible, like a former idea of high class and wealth that
right
now is, like, so outmoded.
Well, because and I think also, you know, even a dirigible was appealing not only because it was comfortable, but because it was also much, much faster than any form mm-hmm. of ground travel, even as slow as a dirigible would have been.
Yeah, it's faster than, you know, boat was, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's another show to talk. We could probably talk about is there was so much development on lighter than air dirigibles, et cetera. In the late 1880s, 1890s, 1910s, 1920s, and 30s, and if you go back and you look at why did they imagine the world was going to be filled with dirigibles and stuff, was airplanes still were very small, couldn't carry much, were very dangerous and inefficient, yet we had a much longer, we had a 100-year history, you know, the Picard brothers, whatever, with balloons and,
right,
and the variations of there. And there was some crazy tech, like there's, we talked about this before, the Navy had one that was an aluminum or zinc clad. It was the zinc clad, a metal dirigible.
Oh, wow.
It was a super thin material, but it was a shiny like metal one that was like, and it was like a metal. It was metal. They were like planning on building aircraft carriers, et cetera. And then airplanes turned out to be kind of really awesome.
Well, and there was even talk about like, you know, setting up a port on the at the top of the Empire State Building. But, mm-hmm. you know, it was just so windy. They couldn't ever make it work.
Yeah. So, you know, that was another, you know, hey, we think this is the future. Then something else comes along the way and you're like, now everything has changed.
Mm-hmm.
What we don't want to change is your support for us.
Absolutely. That's why we encourage you to head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings and support us. Hey, it's so easy. You just go ahead and kick us whatever you think you'd like to support the show with. If you enjoy it, then we really appreciate any kind of financial support that you can give to us. And you, in exchange, get yourself your own custom RSS feed. You can make sure that you get our post show before anybody else. It's so easy, man. I know I say it every week, but there is somebody right now who, when I say custom RSS feed, you're like, more like complicated, I'm never going to do it feed. Basically,
you get an email, you click on the link, you copy it, you paste it into your podcast
to
or
the
whatever
thing you
app
are listening to us on right now,
and
whatever
then, and
you're
then
doing.
You get your very own super special feed that includes the After Things podcast, and it does matter to listen to everything as one big content block.
Yeah.
Including the Weird Things ASMR edition. So, listen, I'm not good at this.
Okay. Are you a goblin?
Yeah, are you a goblin? We stopped dreaming.
Hold on, let me just take a hit on this blunt.
Right, I'm gonna have some Diet Coke.
thank you guys. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
Weird things. This is an addendum. We talked a bit just before about the Boring Company. By the way, they're building a demo. They're building a demo tunnel here in LA. They want to do a demo tunnel from like one by Culver City to the Dodger Stadium, right? And the idea is it's going to be like $1, another way to get in. They will never be able to handle more than like 10% of the capacity that people go there. But they want to build a really cool underground tunnel system to go there. Of course, there are people that object. I mean, that's things like, hey, we're going to build this thing using right away under roads. It's not going to cost anybody anything. We're paying for this out of pocket. We're going to use these bricks for affordable housing. We should be good, right? No.
Well, I mean, it is the NIMBY, right? Not in my backyard. Doesn't matter what it is. Not in my backyard.
Yeah, or under my backyard.
Yeah,
so it's,
not
it's
under like, my. Yeah, yeah. So not a NIMBY.
No.
And it's funny because like, you know, they did a kind of a talk at Dodger Stadium to talk about what they're doing. And some people showed up to show their support. Some were SpaceX employees. So it became, they're trying to AstroTurf this. And it's like, that's not really their their MO right now. Not to say it could be, but that's not really, these are just very, you know, it's like, you know, 8,000 SpaceX employees in LA who probably worked there because they're big fans of, you know, futurism and stuff. But anyhow, it's weird though, because you get the problems you hear an urban planner say it's a bad idea. Urban planner is like a code phrase for, how do I want to describe this? It is a political philosophy. I'll put it that way. It
gotcha.
Is the idea that no, you shouldn't have your own car. No, no, we need to all ride the subway. We need to all ride the bus. This is what we need to do. That's kind of this. And it's like, we need to live in cities. And it's like,
there seems to be a cross section between urban planner and fanfic writer. Right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's it just if
where it's can, like they're like, well, you know how this city should be done.
Exactly.
I'm going to write Houston, the city, even better than the actual.
Than the actual, because they made some really glaring errors that I would like to correct.
And there are arguments to be made for, like, density can lower, you know, overall imprint, you know, on the environment, whatever. There are arguments to be made for all of that, you know, lowering CO2 footprints. And I don't want to hand wave those away. But also, like. So that was an argument. It's like, you know, if you can move towards renewables and other stuff, that like letting people do what they damn well want to, you know, like I like having a car with a couple things that belong to me in it. So if I go somewhere, my jacket or my other stuff that's in my car, I love the idea that I want to go somewhere. I get in my car and I go there. I don't wait for a thing to show up. You know, I don't wait to get on there. You know, my girlfriend likes the idea of not having to, I don't know, travel on public transportation late at night by herself, you know, just
yeah.
Not implying that it's dangerous.
Sorry. Where was this headed? Like,
no, go just that, some people want to, again, on paper, the fan fiction is, oh, look at how much better we would be able to do environmentally, how much more efficient we could be if only we all traveled in tubes.
Right. And then somebody's like, hi, we'd like to make everyone travel in tubes. And they're like, not under my backyard.
Well, or it's just unrealistic. Like, it's unrealistic. And B, a lot of these things happen. You know, urban planners, I guess this is all just our extended diss track on urban planners.
Well, there's like, a story. I'm getting into a story.
All right, go ahead.
So they got Boring Company got permission, and we've talked about, like, hey, where is this going? If they could start building these tunnels and stuff, like, we've talked about the idea of the neighborhood tunnel or whatever, and I think we said, you know, what if your house, what if the tunnel, imagine a tunnel system that connects up from a neighborhood to a larger to a bigger thing that can take you from, you know, take you from LA to San Francisco, you know, ultimately by going in from, like, a smaller, regular old-fashioned tunnel to, you know, like, put your car in the tunnel, then go to a Hyperloop. Well, Boring Company has sought and got permission to build a test garage. Basically, what this is, they want to build a garage that you like a house residential thing, be a test thing. So a car goes into a garage and it lowers down into it and loads up into a tube, drives away.
Dude.
Yeah, right on.
That's dope.
Yeah.
That's great.
And so think about this is the idea of instead of you would build these things like you go into cities like at your building parking garage, you know, like, time to leave work, guys. We're getting the elevator, go to the basement, get in my car, drive my car. Oh, you're going to the exit up there. No, I'm going down to the lowest level of the parking garage and I'm going into that tunnel here where I'm then going to be taken into my.
I don't know. It seems to me like if by the time we have any kind of infrastructure like that, I would imagine that. Virtually nobody is driving by hand. Like everybody's just having the robots.
Oh, this is our new rockets versus
space elevators.
Space elevator. Yeah. Self-driving car versus tubes.
Yeah, I would think.
Oh no, it'll be self-driving in those tubes, bro. Absolutely, 100%
yeah.
Self-driving.
Oh, yeah, we agree.
Boo.
Yeah, no.
Ruining it. I don't want another fight.
I wonder, but, you know, that's one of those things where it's like, I'm sure it'll be a billion times safer, too. You know, there's no traffic.
Well, I guess, but vectors. I guess efficiency is efficiency is efficiency. And you know, this is Tesla wanting to, or Boring Company wanting to get ahead of, you know, the idea of more and more traffic going underground, that even in the most efficient world, like let's say tomorrow, everything is a self-driving car.
Right.
There are still probably going to be choke points, you know, as you go from your house to the airport in Austin.
Oh,
and it would be
sure.
less than.
Right.
It would be the most efficient version of it. But having other capacity underground would help everything.
Oh, absolutely. Right? And keep in mind also, it's like, you know, at that point you, that's just for the version that we drive around in. There's, I'm sure that there are, imagine Amazon just deciding, hey, we're gonna build our own private highways all the way across America, and they're all gonna be in these tubes, or maybe not across America, or networks of them in every city. We're gonna have our own set of Amazon only vehicles going around.
Or they might build their own, like here in LA, in Sylmar, they've got like a facility there. They might build, like, we're gonna build our own trunk line to the main hub.
Yeah,
right. So we can do that. But I mean, it's just there's a crazy kind of future that starts to happen when you start thinking about, like, it's like having this other dimension that we can access, you know, where all of a sudden we're like, hey, you know, we have this extra space that's all around us. And you know, and I understand that skepticism is certainly warranted and should be invited, but it's also listening to the explanations and things like that is worthwhile too, because sometimes you hear the same people say the same thing over again, or the urban planner is like, no, this is not the direction. Like, I don't like that direction. I don't like the thing where I have to wait 30 minutes to get on a thing. That's not the way I want to live. It's not an efficient way for me to live my life. And like, oh, if we're all a little bit more patient, speak for yourself.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that there is a certain element of you know, mass transportation fandom that is slightly a little self-flagellistic for my taste, that, mm-hmm. that, you know, if only we were more concerned about ourselves, then we would, and maybe give up a little bit of our time, then so many more could benefit. When, you know, I think that it's a huge question. It's a very challenging problem to solve, urban development, because you're never really going to be able to go with the cutting edge thing or anything that's cutting edge. By the
time that
it's implemented,
at some point you have to lock in, like, as technology emerged, like, do you just wait forever for the perfect thing, or do you just declare, like, well, we're halfway there. We're going to lay down copper wiring across America and flash freeze it for 70 years with a monopoly with AT&T.
Exactly. But I think we've seen, geez, in the past 10 years, probably the most rapid changes to how one lives their lives between ride sharing and these scooters have effectively changed how I think about getting from one place to another, and radically changed the price of what you can expect from that. Like, and that stuff that isn't urban planning, although you have to be blessed by the government to operate it on some level. But it's very curious to me, like, all right, well, we're making more inroads now than any other point in my lifetime, because the only answer in my lifetime has either been build or fix public transit.
Be patient, yeah.
You know, we'll put more buses or less buses, or fix the buses or fix the train or whatever, or build more highway.
Right.
And now, you know, there's radically different ways to look at how to do everything.
And it changes a lot of things. I just sent Bryce a link. Volvo has released a concept car. They have a concept car, like their version of like the car of the future, right? So self-driving, of course, is part of it. And, you know, everybody's working on this technology. Oh, here we go.
Oh, somebody laying down, taking a nap, sleeping overnight as a car barrels across America at 10 miles an hour.
Yeah, it's like, looks like kind of like, you know, first class, you know, recliner sort of section. So it's a self-driving car that's basically like, we're looking at it overhead through the big sunroof, moonroof thing. And we see, you know, four people facing each other at a table, you know, carrying on. We see some people, just the idea of like, what does it mean when you have real self-driving and dependable self-driving to the point that you're not even thinking about trying to take the control of it. You don't need to have anybody sitting there driving.
Yeah.
What does that mean for transportation? What is it? What does that car become then?
Well, and we've talked about this before, but I am convinced as the numbers roll in and we start to see a stark difference between self-driving cars, accidents, fatalities versus human-driven cars, all of a sudden, very quickly, people will rethink the necessity to even have a cockpit, a driver's seat, basically.
So I have a thought on this. Thinking about this, as I've been driving around my magical Tesla,
yeah.
And you know, enjoying, I use the autopilot all the time, which is great on highways and stuff, because takes control of, keeps you in your lane. It does this. It auto accelerates, brakes, whatever, keeps track of the car in front of you. It's wonderful for LA driving. It's absolutely great for LA driving. But sometimes I like to drive it. Sometimes I like to drive it. It's fun to drive. I hop in there and I like to drive it. And you've heard that people are like, they're never gonna take my car away from me because I've heard that argument. It's like, all right, that's quaint, but I think the way that that kind of does happen is that the advantage when you have self-driving cars is you can go so much faster. And there might be like, yes, you can drive your car, but you got to put that red triangle like we do Amish people, and you've got to stay to the far right of the road, or every car is gonna have. You can drive, but they're going to have Tesla has and other cars have these built-in features. So some cars, if you're heading towards another car, it takes over. It has collision avoidance. It does these things. So I think you can drive, but we're not going to turn the robot off. You know, yeah. If the robot sees you doing something stupid, then you're not going to be driving.
Everything becomes like a virtual bumper cars. Like there's a 6-foot barrier around that the system under no circumstances will allow you to get closer.
And more specifically, making it illegal to not have your crash avoidance online. Yeah.
Certainly, all the HOV lanes become autonomous driving only, enable tethering and you link up a super fast train of cars all maybe 3 feet apart from each other doing 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And then it's like no way a human's allowed to do anything in that space.
Well, and it's interesting, Brian, because you say 100 miles an hour, and that's a thing that we have to start wrapping our heads around when you start getting really efficient self-driving systems. Why not 200 miles an hour? Why not? And of course that
changes the layout of cities. All of a sudden the idea of staying, 30, 40 miles from your place of work is trivial because you're just going to be there in 15 minutes every morning. Your commute's going to be easy as can be.
Yeah. Yeah. What a world. So that sleeper concept car,
this is the beauty of the age that we are in, that I can look at that and equally see a future where that's exactly what it is, or we have some other element that makes it more. The idea of owning a car, it seems less and less, if let's say there are more dependable ways that it's not necessarily like an Uber situation, or it's self-driving Uber where you can,
right.
Some kind of private label thing where it's like you're just getting a different car each time, but it predicts and knows and it waits for you when you are doing a known commute and syncs with your schedule and stuff like that.
Right. Or a whole fleet of them have. Yeah, we talked about this with the idea of virtual apartments that I was suggesting, where it's like, you don't even know where your apartment is in the building. You just know you follow the names that say Justin go this way, and you walk in, and even though maybe you never stay in the same apartment twice, but it always feels like yours because the lighting and the images and the decorations.
You get into your elevator that goes horizontal.
Exactly. You don't even have to walk. You just get into the elevator, and you don't know. Essentially, the elevator kind of becomes like this 3D self-driving car that takes you throughout the entire honeycomb complex and just pops you out in what is the place you're going to sleep tonight.
I'll throw you a different idea, Brian. So you have your apartment, and let's say it is yours because it's got your stuff in there, and it smells like Brian.
Right.
It's got Brian's stuff, and it's got the kids' stuff and your wife's stuff, the family stuff, and you've got this is your travel. You call it your travel room. It's like a Harry Potter thing. Like, this is when we travel. This is this. We've got beds and stuff, whatever, in this. And maybe it's at your house right now. And then you're like, oh, yeah, we're going to go take a trip to Disney World. And in the morning, we're going to leave. We're going to go to the park. And while we're doing this, this thing is going to be transported slower than you, but transported. So the time you get home at night to the hotel at night or to the park at night, wherever you're at, your room is there.
It's your house. Oh, wow. Yeah. That's great. That's interesting. Or at least maybe a section of the house. Maybe
a section. Part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like an RV that detaches.
It's like 2 days before. It's like, hey, kids, this weekend we're going to Disney World. Make sure that if you care about it, put it in the transport room. And then otherwise it won't be there. And then, that's great.
Yeah. And then you're like, oh, we'll go to a Disney hotel and sleep in their beds, use their bathroom and stuff, but we'll have our own.
You'll have the room. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, that's awesome. Oh, the future. It's awesome.
I think we're think about the things we take for granted now that when it comes to travel, a credit card, just a credit card alone, is an amazing idea. I don't carry cash. I carry this thing with this piece of plastic because we've built a financial infrastructure, everything else around it, and fraud, all these other issues. But I walk any place in the world, I pull out this little piece of plastic and like, hey, can I get these services and things like this? Yeah, for sure. You know, in the United States, we have such a level of trust. You can walk into a place, sit down, start eating, have people bring you things, whatever. Then, only then, once you're done, do they say, oh, can you pay for this?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're like, oh, yeah, I can pay for this. Okay. You know, things like that. And then, like, of course, travel and stuff, like, you know, like you go to a city, like, oh, well, I'll just pull out my phone, Uber, you know, I'll go look for a hotel. Got a hotel.
Boy, done. That's you want to talk about a game changer that has changed lives. It is amazing to me that I will land in a city not having any idea where anything is, not having any guaranteed room, not having any transportation.
You're also incredibly irresponsible.
Well, yes,
but you are.
Like, that's not a deliverance.
No. But this is Brian is the stress test.
But
on the system.
Yeah, it's like it's fine. It works out fine.
I know.
You can do all of those things at home beforehand too for cheaper.
Yeah, but then you're locked in.
Oh, yeah. All that stuff.
There's a dollar value to flexibility.
The thrill of the chase.
I'll do New York. Like, I'll get a ticket to New York, and, like, I won't get a hotel room. I'll just use hotels tonight, and I'll play that roulette. If I can't get a good rate, then I'll just pay a high rate, you know?
Right. No. I think hotels are always that's a safe bargain to just go somewhere without a hotel, because you're generally able to find something cheaper, about as cheap as you would find it a month ahead of time. Flights and stuff, you should probably book a little bit earlier.
Correct.
It's certainly the shape of these things is going to, it's hard to imagine, but somebody pointed out, said, hey, I'd like this, the travel room for Dragon Con, so they could put all their stuff in there. And something we talked about is that, like, when you can rent a robo RV system, like an Uber, and have that overnight, why go to Atlanta and the stinking seating masses that we are when we converge on Dragon Con, and the long lines and rude behaviors, they tell you to stand here and do this, when we can say, hey, Brian's got a compound. But we can say, hey, we've got an empty field somewhere, and like do it like the World Quidditch match, you know, just like, we're all just going to show up here because, oh, we need toilets. Boom, app delivers toilets on the scene. Oh, we need food trucks. Boom, robo food trucks show up. Oh, we need hotel rooms. Oh, boom, you know, entire trucks filled with like little Japanese micro hotels are at a location or already there. You go to, you hold conventions in places where they have hotel rooms. But if you can have your hotel rooms anywhere you want.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, imagine if the camping experience was almost completely removed from Burning Man, where it's like you just you selected your plot, you selected from a menu of what you want ready and prepared for you, and robots wheel in all the pods, set everything up, everything's customized the way you like it, and you don't even have to experience the driving out there or the setting up of a tent or any of that stuff. You just get into an auto drive car and suddenly, or you wake up in the morning and you're like, oh, I'm in Black Rock City.
And by the way, that also fundamentally changes those events coming together, because if now we all connect online, if you can say, hey, let me just share my calendar, everyone's going to share their calendar.
All of a sudden the date becomes flexible.
All of a sudden,
and it's decided,
everyone just gets an email and says, hey, the required rooms, entertainment space, and you know, sanitation facilities,
everything's most affordable,
are all available and most affordable during this time. Now let's take a little plebiscite of a final yay or nay on this time, and boom, it's everything can be automated to a point where you're not even worrying. I mean, for us, if we were going to put together Weird Con, right, or Diamond Con, or something where we're going to have a weird thing, we would be taking a guess on a city. We'd be taking a guess on the turnout.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be taking a guess on whether or not everybody would be able to afford the rates that we'd be able to put together. And we'd be taking a guess on everybody else's schedule to see whether or not they would even be able to come in the first place, or if they'd want to go to something else. So they got some other thing.
Right.
That this could take away all those problems. It would all happen on the back end. If anything, we would get an email. We would all get an email saying, hey, you can put together this on this date, based on all available informations and indications, you would get a turnout of this, you would make this much money. Would you like to yes or no? Is this the date that you are going to have this thing?
That's pretty good. What's funny is, like, I want to, I'm thinking in terms of, like, what would it take to set that up? I'm like, oh, you would have a website, everyone would register their fanship or whatever. And it's like, no. If you have a smart enough AI, you don't even have anyone register stuff. It just takes a look at social media profiles because you can know more about people's tastes than their spouse after, you know, 300 likes or whatever from that. And then based on that publicly available information, it's like, okay, look, 98% chance this person is a big fan of you guys. Looking at their schedule, their past posts, there's a 87% chance that they'll be free on this weekend. I've already run demographic profile information of how much money they make, how much they can afford in disposable income. I've done that now. I've done that for one person. Now I've done it for 100,000 people, and I've calculated that you should do 4 conventions, and if you just check yes, I'll schedule them for you. I'll tell you when they are. You're going to make this many thousands of dollars per conference, and we're good. And then it is like, yes, no. Man, that's really going to happen in our lifetime, like in the next 10 to 20 years.
I mean, that would, like, the bones of that tool are probably available now.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
but you just don't need the human touch, and then all of a sudden it becomes scalable for everyone.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think even the simpler one of, like, if we told everyone who's a fan of this podcast, is go to the site, plug in your availability, and we can do that. I mean, I think that's, and I think, Brian, your tool is like, is a forecasting way to say, like, when do we want to choose, try to base on that? Because, like, you're having a lot less, there's been the shift in social media engagement too, which is something worth talking about how a lot, you know, the younger, particularly younger demographics are trying to go more closed and not.
Oh, think about this. What if your AI was basically like a virtual agent and it was able to run simulations based on known things? It says, okay, look, right now you've never met, let's say, Grant Thompson, the King of Random. And you've also never met, let's say, the Ice Cream Social team, right? Mm-hmm. Here's the plan. If, according to my demographic information, if you did 2 crossover videos with Grant Thompson over the next year and 3 appearances on Ice Cream Social, and they made cross promo with Grant, then by my algorithmic estimation, you can create a con based around the 3 of your properties that would bring in this much more money. Also, I've taken the liberty of A/B testing names for the convention. The name of the convention, this is the one that tests highest. This is the type of venue that will work most. Man, that's crazy. That's so weird.
And Brian, I've built a 3D deepfake of you that's going to go on these shows and
in
do
fact,
this.
I've already simulated. Here's a promo reel. Just
you
go
are
ahead.
Great. You yeah. are great.
You killed it, dude.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Ariana Grande's weird and cool and scary and all that. Another thing I'll throw in too is, like, you've seen these inflatable tents.
Sure.
So, like, you could throw your con and say in the middle of nowhere and
oh yeah, the ones where it's like they're pressurized and so that's what keeps it all afloat.
Yeah,
it's all climate control.
Like, oh, we're gonna want to have some meeting rooms, some gaming rooms and stuff. You know, we're gonna want to have the Hearthstone. You know,
yeah.
Oh, dude, that's so dope.
By the way, Hearthstone pop up book's coming out like in a month.
What? Oh my god, I'm so excited.
Yeah. So just so you know. So yeah, I mean, it's just I think that's just in time for BlizzCon, the future probably. Is pop up. You know, it's just this, you know, which it's going to be like Harry Potter in a way. But,
and that's the crazy part, too, is like it'll be clean and convenient and comfortable and nice. And probably I bet there's an environmental angle to sell people on it. It's wild because so much of what we do is because what we seek is a sense of community. We seek a sense of contentment and happiness and joy and excitement. And if you can just cut out the middle steps, like that's where the increasing efficiency is going to be, which is part of why, like, virtual worlds have done so well, is because think about board games. Like, you didn't love the game, sorry, what you loved was being with people and feeling that connection and feeling like, oh,
big shots
except
sorry.
For the game, sorry.
Hey, sorry.
Well, and so meanwhile we live in a world where we've virtualized that kind of experience with games like Hearthstone and stuff, and so you're able to always, you know, if you have a 15 minute block of time, you can suddenly go to that moment and have that experience.
Sweet. Gentlemen, want to do picks?
Yeah, man. I am reading a book called, I believe it's called The Righteous Mind. Have you read it?
Oh, the Jonathan Haidt?
Yeah. It's great. It's great. I can't believe I'm so late to it.
I've hung out with him in, like, you know, Yellowstone. Does that count?
Oh, my gosh.
Wait.
With the dunk. Where I got that? Dunked on.
Oh, man. Andy, you got to secure the name with two hands or else you're going to drop it.
You got to throw it out your back like that.
Oh, JoJo's book. Yeah.
It's
JoJo. JoJo's not really his name, but...
yeah, the whole middle section where it talks about different types of priorities of focus for righteousness, about like you know, purity over contagions or contamination, or loyalty over a betrayal, or you know, virtue over whatever, you know, doing good. It's fascinating stuff, and I love looking at the world pulled out of, you know, our sort of dreaming through, like, I'm in this tribe, I believe this, liberals are lazy, conservatives are jerks, you know. It gives a really high fidelity framework to view all of that stuff, and I think it's way, way good. I'm enjoying it a lot, The Righteous Mind. And the yeah. audiobook is read by the author and very well performed.
You know, his hates, one of his height rather, and one of his great contributions has been, kind of like Steven Pinker, wonderful scholarship to such hot button topics when it comes to belief systems and politics and stuff like this. Because the problem is, a lot of people who do research in this might come from one point of view or another. And if they're from our point of view, like, yeah, this is great research, I like this, but be like, yeah, but they work for such and such group and other this, and discounted. And that's problematic. And I think his stuff has been very, very, very well done in just kind of documenting how different groups perceive each other and whatnot. And, you know, the problem is that we all have a point at which we want to back away from self and introspection, or, you know, self. We all have a point at which, like, we get a little bit uncomfortable when we start pointing that at ourselves. And, like, I know I have this. I'm an advocate. We all need to be critical. We all need to be this, this, this. There's a point at which I'm like, eh, all right, that's enough. But
that's enough trying to do the right thing. Can we just be lazy and call them the other?
Yeah, and I think the problem is, I think most people we could deal with a lot more, particularly if you're. If you're finding yourself on social media tweeting out your politics a lot to other people and you don't quite know your audience, or you're just looking for people to say, yeah, you're right, or you're trying to start a fight, maybe some introspection would be a really good idea. What are you really after? Are you after change? You know, are you after change? Or, because, like, I get people who, when I work for the James Randi Foundation, dealing with people who believed really crazy things, there was a mindset I encountered of this. I know what truth is. I know what truth is. I know what reality is. I'm like, well, you're crazy. And I get that a lot now from people in politics. And I know what right is. I know what truth is. And I know what this is. It's like, there's evidence, which is this thing we can look at. And there's the evidence you choose to look at. And there's this, but I get kind of an icky feeling.
The most important thing that I'm taking away from the book so far is the importance of one side learning to speak the language of the other side. Mm-hmm. And he takes, for example, he takes Obama to task for, John Kerry's speeches all tended to play only to the things that Democrats cared about, the rightness, the fairness, or whatever. And part of the reason he lost is because, according to JoJo, he did not do play to the things that matter to the Republicans, the conservative values. Oh. He didn't.
Is this where you get your gun license?
Right. He did not play to the loyalty heuristic and or the paradigm and the contamination paradigm. And anyway, it's great. It's really, really good.
Cool.
My pick is Brian and I got the opportunity to do the Everything's Coming Up Simpsons podcast.
Yeah.
Here in Austin over the weekend. And they, Ali and Julia, have a new book coming out called 100 Things the Simpsons, or Fans of the Simpsons, Must Do. Let me see if I can get that one right. But it was a great time. I've not read the book yet, but if it is anything like their delightful, super awesome fandom is. Yeah, 100 Things the Simpsons Fans Should Do Before They Die, written by Allie Gertz and Julia Prescott. So I would highly recommend that. And go listen to Everything's Coming Up Simpsons when Brian and I's episode come out. We did The Otto Show, the episode in season
three
where Spinal Tap makes a cameo.
Oh, cool.
It was really interesting because we were trying to figure out, given its timing in 1992, whether it was, I mean, I'm certain the reason it was Spinal Tap is just because, you know, they're able to pick up the phone and be like, hey, come be on our cartoon. They're like, yeah, sure, whatever. But we didn't know if it was a statement of like, are they super popular, or is the fact that it was a 15-year-old mockumentary sort of like they were the right amount of aged out, that they were a little older school?
Well, how old was Spinal Tap? Like in 1992, it was only like 10 years old or something, too.
Yeah, right? Yeah. No, 79 is when Spinal Tap, the documentary, comes out. And
79?
Yeah, so 13 years.
Yeah, 92 is when this episode aired.
Long enough that it, you know, I didn't know if it was meant to feel old or forever or whatever.
Two things. You know, I was at Universal Studios last night, and the Simpsons Land there is really cool. Like, they sell the giant donuts. There's like, they have like the Springfield prison where they have, you can see Sideshow Bob escaping out the side of it, which is pretty cool.
Oh, that's great.
And a thing I highly recommend for Simpsons fans is go to a live read if you can. That is really cool.
So, oh, wait, they do live reads there?
Well, I mean, I went to a live read over at Fox Lot.
That's not even a name drop. Yeah, it's just bragging about a thing you did.
I'm not going to name the director who invited me there and how many Emmys he got. It's just
All right. Wait, what about you? Is that your pick? We'll just put you down for if you can. I highly recommend.
Yeah. If you can afford
being Andrew Main and hanging out with the Simpsons cast.
I highly recommend it.
Listen. Oh, you guys didn't invite. I'm sorry. Just enjoy your little hangout there.
No, initially I thought like that'd be like a really, really cool thing if they got like, you know, voice actors or people that like.
And they'll do that for example, over at the Universal Orlando, they do the what is called the Hollywood Makeup Special Effects Show.
Yeah.
But then really, it's just it's an improv comedy show.
Yeah.
With certain scheduled beats and payoffs, and you could do that exact same thing with like a Simpsons live read experience.
On that note. If you make a trip to LA, go before you go, go look at LA live events and stuff like this, because it is not hard to find an event where you're going to see, they do actually like they'll do live reads of movie scripts, things like this.
Yeah.
You get celebrities to show up and do this sort of thing done all the time. So it's not like this, ooh, you got to go to this. Like, yeah, that thing maybe, but there's a lot of cool stuff on.
For a while, wasn't it like Jason Reitman that was doing like a regular live show where he just would get awesome celebrities to like do live reads of movie scripts? Like, I remember he did a all-female Glengarry Glen Ross with like all these like badass women doing these like very alpha male kind of roles.
That's awesome.
And they had like last week they did The Predators. They did a screening and it was a free screening and Shane Black was there, you know, with the Q&A.
Yeah.
So it's like they have like this stuff happens here. It becomes like, oh yeah, I just did that thing this week. Oh, or like there's Jeff Goldblum performs. I forget at what hotel he likes to perform it with his jazz band. And he just hangs out for like an hour before or whatever. And if anybody who shows up early, you just go talk to Jeff Goldblum. I mean, it's like that kind of like, that's the weirdness of this town, is that it's like, if you know where to go and it's not hard to find out where to go, you're like,
But by the way, my sub pick is there's somebody, I guess Jeff Goldblum's got some new internet series. But so I saw a clip, a viral clip of just only the nonverbal noises that that Jeff Goldblum makes,
like a super cut.
Yeah, it was just a super cut of all edited together. Him just being like, ooh.
Okay.
But yeah, this is all from the movies. He's great, Jeff Goldblum, National Treasure. You can see him in Hollywood.
Bryce, do you have any picks?
Yeah, I had some friends over, and I only had a little bit of time last night after we were hanging out, but it was just enough time to finish watching the new season of American Vandal on Netflix.
How was it?
It's really good. It's really good. I don't know that it's like twisty in the same way season one was, but I think its focus on, you know, modern digital life is a stronger message than in season one. Season one is almost a little incidental, or like it's a technique. But here it's really well done, and it's, man, I did not get the feeling of this with season one, but season two was a quick watch. You know, they're,
how many episodes?
They're 8 episodes.
Oh, that's quick. Yeah.
And they're like 30, they're a little over 30 minutes each. So it actually does pick up, and they do a really great thing in the first episode to sort of talk about the first season and why the production values are so high in that first season.
Yeah.
And it gives like a plot device for Sam and Peter to be on the other side of the camera, because in the first season they're kind of trading off and doing production work. And even that little bit right near the beginning is a funny, like, not a retcon, but it's a good explanation.
A reframe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So American Vandals on Netflix.
Yeah, season one. I loved season one, and I very much appreciated that it was a much smarter show. And it, the beats for me that resonated beyond, yeah, I guess I was just happy that for a show that has as silly a premise as it is, it's, you know, a serial true crime style look into a fairly trivial vandalism accident. All the, or not accident, you know, attack.
Attack, yeah.
All the characters felt real. The stakes, minor though they might be, all felt like they meant something to the characters.
Right.
And ultimately, understanding that they were starting at a very silly place, they got to a more serious place, which I thought was a remarkable.
And, and I will say about season two is it's still like a wacky sort of premise, the idea of making an entire school poop their pants during lunch.
I didn't know the inciting incident in the second season.
It's in the Netflix trailer. It's like, if you let it play, you're like, oh my God, that's disgusting.
It's gratuitous. I was eating during it and I was like, oh Jesus. But it kind of loses some of that character, because it's a pretty much new cast of characters because it's a new school. I don't know that it quite has the same like connection that you have to the crew in the first one, but it's still stronger in the mystery side of this one. So especially if you like the first one, you should definitely check out season two. What do you have, Andrew?
One, I'm gonna have to do a shout out again for all Ozark season one, by the way. Ozark season one, and then comment like, oh, is it a Breaking Bad knockoff? And like, I'm sure it got greenlit because it appealed to a Breaking Bad audience. I don't doubt that at all.
It feels a lot more like The Shield to me, where you have somebody who at the very first episode you think, oh, this dude is screwed, and then yet he just keeps squeaking by, and it you feel that noose tightening constantly around. It's fantastic.
I just finished season two of Ozark. Pretty good season.
Yeah.
It's an interesting season.
Exceptional. The head writer on that, Whit Anderson, she wrote on Daredevil season two and whatnot. I think the writing's top notch, great team, whatever. My pick though is like, man, Hulu, you know, like everybody else is like, hey, we're going to do streaming too. And like, oh, that's adorable. You know, Hulu is like, we're going to do streaming. We're going to do our own shows. And they do Handmaid's Tale and everybody loves that show. And it's a huge monster hit. Like, okay. And then they go, oh, we're going to do Castle Rock. We're going to do a story set. Oh, they did Runaways, which was fantastic. I love Runaways, which I enjoyed that. And Future Man is really good. But I'm like, yeah.
He's just looking at the marquee on Hulu.
I know. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that was really good too. Oh, yeah. That was
Hoosiers.
Really good.
I love Hoosiers.
Oh,
yeah, I remember that movie.
Well, combo breaker.
So then they say, oh, we're going to do Castle Rock, which is not based on a specific Stephen King story, but set in the Stephen King universe, whatever that's going to mean. And I'm like, all right, I'll give this a shot, because, like, you know, just finished watching, you know, other anthology stuff and looking for something neat in anthology. I'm like, God, let me check this out. Watch first episode. Like, ah, it's good. Second, like, it's pretty good. Third episode, I'm like, oh, this is really good. Like, fourth, fifth, I'm like, I'm hooked into this. My girlfriend and I are looking forward to each new episode of it. And then, like, kind of later in the season, you know, it just goes kind of like crazy. And it's awesome, great. And like, I mean, I just finished it and it's self-contained, 10 episodes, and very happy. And I would say that Stephen King long stories don't, for me, really work that well in TV or mediums, because they just sort of, and now we're done. You know, yeah. Now we're done. You know, we just, now we've reached our end, and this was other writers coming in here, and there's a conclusion, and it may not be satisfying for everybody, but I dug it. I really, really dug it. Very,
dude,
very happy.
That's really, really good to hear. I do like the idea that he's just easily distractible. It's like everything's really good, and then suddenly he's like, that dog looks like sneakers. and then he just wanders off.
So that's my
Castle
pick.
Rock.
Castle. So. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.